Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Stephen Roby, who's here with his new book, Hendricks on Hendricks. We thank Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Stephen Roby's new book, Hendricks on Hendricks, Interviews and Encounters with Jimi Hendrix, includes the most important interviews from the peak of Jimi Hendrix's career, 1966 to 1970. Hendrix recalls for reporters his heartbreaking childhood, his concept of electric church music intended to wash people's souls and give them a new direction, and his wish to be remembered as not just a guitar player. Stephen Roby is a respected Jimi Hendrix historian, archivist, and author. He's written feature articles and reviews for Billboard and Guitar World. He was editor of Straight Ahead, the international Jimi Hendrix fanzine, and the Hendrix family's authorized fanzine, Experience Hendrix. His previous books include Becoming Jimi Hendrix and Black Gold, the Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix. So this is the eve of what would have been Jimi Hendrix's 70th birthday tomorrow, November 27th, and we're very pleased to host this event. So Stephen Roby will speak, and then he'll answer your questions, and following that, he'll sign books at the front table. So thanks again to Elliott Bay, and please join me in welcoming Stephen Roby to the Seattle Public Library. Thanks.
Good evening. Good evening. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Good evening. Thank you for coming out tonight, and welcome. It's great to be back in Seattle, and it's great to be back at this wonderful auditorium here at the Seattle Public Library. I was just telling Chris, it was about 10 years ago I was here and lectured for the Black Gold Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix book. And thanks to Elliott Bay Books, who came out tonight and brought some books. I'd be happy to sign later. So let's get into it. Let's start a bit with my background here. Here's a very embarrassing picture of me in 1967 turning on my FM radio and hearing Jimi Hendrix for the first time. And that's what turned me around. And here we are 42 years later, and I'm still enjoying his music. As Chris was mentioning, in the 80s, I started a fanzine called Straight Ahead, the International Jimi Hendrix Fanzine. I decided it was time to get collectors together and put out Jimi Hendrix news. It was years before the internet, and I felt there needed to be a news source. The paper started out as a 4-page, 11 by 17, monthly, and then went to a bi-monthly 52-page issue that I did out of my house. So it was a total labor of love. That went on to 1996 when I went to work for the family of Jimi Hendrix, and I'm proud to say that Al Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix's father, was my boss for a brief period of time. In 2002, I wrote this book, Black Gold, The Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix, with a foreword by Noel Redding. And then in 2007, I did this wild project. I get some wild ideas once in a while. Country Joe McDonald of Country Joe and the Fish broke the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's largest guitar ensemble by getting some acoustic guitar players to play Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land. And I thought, well, if Country Joe could do it with a Woody Guthrie song, why not do it with a Jimmy song? So I registered with the Guinness Book of World Records and did this thing at Westfest, which was a Woodstock anniversary tribute concert. What I didn't realize is that it was hard to get 3,000 guitar players together on a Sunday morning. Usually musicians like to gig late at night on Saturday nights, and they didn't want to come out to Golden Gate Park, cold, foggy, 10 o'clock in the morning, but we did get about close to 500 guitar players, families of all different ages. It was a wonderful sight to see. Purple Haze is a kind of a hard song to play, but it was fun to see that amount of people out there playing Jimmy's music. In 2002, this book came out, Becoming Jimi Hendrix, From Southern Crossroads to Psychedelic London. I co-wrote this with my friend Brad Schreiber. This documents for the first time Jimmy's early years as an R&B musician struggling in America to make a name for himself, and leaves off where my next book, my current book, Hendrix on Hendrix, starts. It begins with his first press interview shortly after he arrived in England as an unknown, just breaking into the music business, you know, in a major way, and ends with his final interview given just about a week before he died. So let's talk about the relevance and the importance of a book like Hendrix on Hendrix. And let me ask you a question. Have you ever seen this slogan associated with Hendrix? It's usually on the back of a Toyota Tercel, a 1987 Toyota Tercel, right next to a world visualized world peace sticker, or it's all over Facebook. And it's associated with Jimi Hendrix. Just a quick show of hands, how many people think Jimmy said this? Oh, you got two. You are on the right track here. About a week ago, I had lunch with my wife, and I found this on the bottom of a bottle cap, the same slogan, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace, and Jimi Hendrix. Ironically enough, the name of the company is Honest Tea, and I wrote them a little email, which I'll tell you about in a second here. Anybody know who this guy is? I'll buy you a free book if you know who this guy is. Oh, what was that?
Edison?
Nope. The correct answer we're looking for tonight is William E. Gladstone. He was the UK Prime Minister in the 1800s. He said that slogan. This is what Jimmy said. With the power of soul, anything is possible. So my email to Honest Tea got them to switch it around to something Jimmy sent. I sent them a copy of the book, so they're going to use an actual Hendrix quote, and it will be an honest Jimi Hendrix quote. So to me, that was the importance of writing this book, is to getting Jimmy's words as accurate as possible. I know you'll see the other phrase on Facebook all the time. People get a warm, fuzzy feeling, but Jimmy didn't say that. In Hendrix on Hendrix, it starts out, Jimmy talks about his childhood here in Seattle growing up and what it was like, his years at Garfield High, his years in the Army, and as I mentioned before, a struggling R&B musician and the rock icon that he eventually became. And let's listen to Hendrix talking about his early years and how he overcame his stage fright.
Now, is it very easy to just grab a guitar, go on stage and
no.
bang?
It was so, well, you know, it was so very hard to me, because at first, man, oh, I was so scared. I wouldn't dare go on stage. No, you know, like I joined this band, I knew about three songs. And when it was time for us to play on stage, man, I was, you know, like this, you know. And then I had to play behind the curtains, you know. I couldn't get up in front. So after, and then, plus you get so very discouraged. You hear different bands playing around you. And the guitar player seems like it's always so much better than you are, you know. And then most people give up at this point because, you know, they get very discouraged. But it's best not to be, you know, just keep on, just keep on. If you're very stubborn, you can, you know, make it. That's the only way I'm, you know, try to make it. It's being very persistent.
I think it's hard to imagine Hendrix having stage fright playing here in some of the early bands as he played as a teenager here in Seattle, playing behind the curtains or something. Quick history lesson. Anybody know who this lead singer is in this photo? Wilson Pickett is the right answer. And there's a bonus point if you know the guitar player that Jimmy is playing right next to. This is going back to 1966. We're looking for Cornell Dupree. Cornell Dupree and Jimi Hendrix were in King Curtis's band. Not to be confused with this band, this is Curtis Knight and Squires. And this is the last R&B band Jimmy played with before he left for England. Let's listen now to Hendrix talk about some of the early days and what prompted him to go to England.
Well, like I was playing behind different top 40 R&B groups here in the States, you know, for about off and on for about 4 or 5 or 6 years.
just got tired and went to the village and had my own group together, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so Jess Chandler comes through and asks if I'd like to come to England. You know, he's seen us down in the village and asks if I'd like to come to England. So I went over there.
I wasn't thinking about nothing but the idea of going to England. That's all I was thinking about. Because I like to travel, you know. One place bores me too long, so I have to, you know, try to see if I can get something together by moving somewhere else. And the idea of England, this was the idea of England itself. So, wow, you know, I've never been there before.
Okay, this is where the book starts, Hendricks on Hendricks. Hendricks is just leaving New York City, Greenwich Village. He started his first solo band called Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, and he's been discovered by Chas Chandler, who brings him over to England, and we'll listen to that now.
You are supposed to be something very new and very fresh in pop business. How do you feel about that yourself?
There's so many different outlets, you know, we have so many different things. Like, hey, Jules, it's one little, about 100, you know, of our feelings. We like it, that's why we recorded it, you know. But we have so many different other sounds, you know, that we just barely begun.
I don't know if you could hear on that recording, that was one of his first interviews there. He was talking about Hey Joe. Hey Joe, the first single had just come out. And if you only heard Hey Joe, you would have no indication of where Jimmy was going to next. So that's what he was kind of saying. We've only just begun. Get ready for something exciting to come up. So we're still in 1966, going into 1967 now. And here's Hendricks talking about what it would be like going to America, you know, the place where he started, and how he would be accepted.
What do you think of your chances in America?
It'll be all right, you know. It's gonna be all right, just like over here now. It's just, America's just like any other country, it just takes a little more time, that's all.
And here we have some scenes from the Monterey Pop Festival, where Jimmy essentially got his start in America here, burning his guitar, setting it on fire, smashing it up. Just over EMP today, you can see what's left of it. There it goes. So what happened after Hendricks played Monterey? He opened up for the Monkees. Hendricks, in my book, Hendricks on Hendricks, he talks about what it was like being with the Monkees. And it only lasted about 8 shows. In early July, he left them opening as an opening act and went on the psychedelic ballroom circuit. So that's about enough of the Monkees I can take. So we're still in 1967. Jimmy was probably not the best businessman in the world. He just wanted to play his guitar. And a contract that he signed in 1965 came back to bite him. It was one of the contracts he didn't tell his new manager, Chas Chandler, about. Let's take a look at it now. You probably should be able to see this pretty good on the big screen here. But pay attention to the amount Jimmy gets paid here and some of the royalties that he's getting here. He only got $1 for signing this contract. But it was a binding 3-year contract from the years 65 through 68. And as many of you know, some of his best material came out in that period. So the owner of this contract, a New York producer, who became quite famous for doing cover songs and recording them here in America and then selling them overseas, and they would do great. So Hendricks was signed for a session player. He got $1 and a very small, tiny percentage of this. So this contract came back to bite him. And in my book, Hendricks on Hendricks, we go into a 1968 court pretrial deposition. Hendricks is under oath. It's not really an interview, but this is what we're kind of calling an encounter, where he's asked a whole different series of questions, and you can read that in the book. So this producer continued to exploit Jimmy's music that was recorded from 65 and 66, and it started coming out, and it drove Hendrix crazy. And I think you could see that on the face, his face here as he's holding up one of the singles there. So let's continue on to 1968, and it's question time again. Anybody know who the who's on the cover of this Teen Set magazine? Grace Slick, that's right. And she's in blackface because it's just right after the Summer Olympics. And if you recall that famous scene with the Black Power salute and the athletes that had just won the medals there, she's replicating that. And if you look hard enough on YouTube, you probably can find a clip from the Smothers Brothers where she's in blackface, I think doing lather off of Crown of Creation there. So that's what it's all about. So why is this magazine important? It's because there's a great interview in there with Jimmy. It's called Jimi Hendrix, Black Power and Money. And it's the most radical interview I've ever heard Hendrix do. And you've got to remember, we're in 1968 now. It was a very chaotic time in America. We had riots in the streets. We had a Democratic convention. But more importantly, we had the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were both assassinated. So it was a crazy time in America. So this is what Hendrix said in the interview. Get the Black Panthers, not to kill anybody, but to scare the government. It's hard to say. I know it sounds like war, but that's what's going to have to happen. It has to be war if nobody's going to do it peacefully. That's Hendrix. I mean, he goes on to say a lot more than that. You know, we have to fight fire with fire. So he was basically calling for a revolution. So keep this in mind as we go on to the next slide here. As we jump ahead to 1969, where Hendrix is busted for heroin and hashish as he's crossing the border into Toronto, Canada. It makes the cover of Rolling Stone magazine and also gathers the attention of these two guys, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, of the FBI, and President Richard Nixon. The FBI creates a lengthy file on Hendrix, partly too because he was a supporter of the Black Panthers and a very outspoken person about what was going on in America there. So in the book, there's his court transcription of when he was under oath fighting this charge against him for heroin and hashish possession. So you can read that transcript. And he answers a couple of very serious questions there. He was asked about why he has incense in his flight bag there. Strange question to ask. But Hendrix's response is because he has bad kitchen odors, and that's what he uses his incense for. Okay, it's 1969 again. It's the summer of 1969. Hendrix is forming a new band. The original Jimi Hendrix Experience has broken up, and he's making some television debuts in America. He appears on the Dick Cavett Show twice and the Johnny Carson Show, except Johnny Carson is not the host. Flip Wilson is the host. And I thought it was kind of interesting, too, as I was doing the transcriptions for all three of those television appearances, is that on the Carson Show, Flip Wilson is the host, but you've also got Joe Tex and Wilson Pickett are also guests on the thing. Unfortunately, archivists like myself and others have tried to find the video of that, but luckily some soul was out there with a home tape recorder and recorded that. So for the first time, you can read the transcription to that interview there. But let's give a listen now, a quick listen to Hendrix on the Dick Cavett Show and his opinion about his philosophy of electric church music.
I turn him on. It's really amazing. I want to clear something with you. I heard you use the expression an electric church as an ambition you had. Was this speaking metaphorically or poetically, or do you really want to?
Well, let's see. I don't know. It's just a belief that I have. You know, it's. And as we do use electric guitars, everything, you know, is electrified nowadays, you know. Mm-hmm. So therefore the belief comes into, you know, through electricity to the people, whatever. That's why we play so loud, because it doesn't actually hit through the eardrums like most groups do nowadays. You know, they say, well, we're going to play loud too because they're playing loud. And they got this real shrill sound, you know, and it's really hard. We plan for our sound to go inside the soul of the person, actually, you know, and see if they can awaken some kind of thing in their minds, you know, because there's so many sleeping people. You can call it that if you want to.
Jimi Hendrix on the Dick Cavett Show in 1969. Let's stay in 1969 for a moment. One of the interesting things I found while I was doing research for Hendrix on Hendrix is that Hendrix would open up a lot more to, if the reporter was a female, he seemed to relax a little bit more. And this next interview was done with a lady, her name was Nancy Carter, and she was doing her master thesis for the University of Southern California. And she got permission from Hendrix's management to work on her thesis, and as part of that is to interview Hendrix at his hotel room in Beverly Hills. So we'll give a listen to that now.
What do you think the sound of the future will be then?
Well, I don't know. I'm not no critic. You know, I can just only go by what I want on my own side. I like to get into more symphonic things so then kids can respect the old music, traditional, you know, like classics. I like to mix that in with, you know, with so-called rock today. But it's always changing according to the attitude of the people, you know. When the air is static, loud, and aggressive, that's how the music gets. When the air starts getting peaceful and harmonic and so forth, that's how the music will get. So it's up to the people how it's going to be. But music is going to be here regardless if it's rock or whatever, you know. And it's going to influence a whole lot of people's minds now because, like I said before, that's part of their church now.
You know. Well, music is considered extremely emotional, and it's supposed to rid the individual of frustration. That's what they say.
Yeah, if people let it.
It's marvelous.
Yeah, instead of trying to...
I can tell you that from my own experience. If I'm really uptight, I'm tense and everything, yeah. I go to somewhere like the whiskey and really enjoy myself.
Or they listen to Andy Williams or something. You know, he's very relaxing, for instance, you know.
Who knew Jimi Hendrix was a fan of Andy Williams' music, the light Andy Williams? Good music, but I didn't know Jimmy was a fan of Andy Williams there. So let's go on to the next slide. Which
do
I'd
you
like to
personally accept. Feel that the excitement has gone out of things? I mean,
no, I was feeling like that before because I was thinking too fast, you know. Seems like, you know, a person has the tendency to get bored because, like, he always wants to try to do all these accomplishments, you know. Like starting an idea, something like that, and never quite finishing it out, you know.
Do you feel that lack, that you've never really been truly... criticized as a songwriter?
Well, probably it was a good thing because I'm still trying to get that together. You know, all I'm writing is just what I feel, that's all. I hate to be put as only a guitar player or either only as a songwriter or only as a tap dancer or something like this. I like to move around.
Is it important for you to achieve recognition as a songwriter?
I don't know, really. I guess it would be if I wanted to stay back and predominantly write songs when I can't go on stage anymore.
You were quoted in one paper as saying that you didn't really care what you did as long as you turned people on,
yeah.
Right? Now, what do you want to turn people on to apart from your music? Is there any moral or political intent in the kind of things you want to write?
Oh, no, I like them to get easier in the mind a little bit because there's too many heavy songs out nowadays. Music is getting, you know, or at least it has been getting too heavy, like, you know. Almost to the state of unbearable, you know. I have this one little saying, when things get too heavy, just call me helium, the lightest known gas to man. But then again.
So where are your inspirations for songs coming at the present time, and where are you turning to for your directions as a writer?
For my just recent experiences. what I try to do is, like, look at the totality of that and give them the other half, you know. First of all, you have the one half, and then the second half, the solution, or whatever it might be, which is the second. First of all, you have the experience, and you have the use of it all, you know. And, like, I was just trying to go through a lot of changes, and I could write the nice parts about it, you know. But right now, it's taking a while.
Do you feel at all concerned that, you have been quoted as saying in the past that music will, the next...
classic.
No, the next wheel, as it were, the next circle of music, that we're now at an end of something, and the next stage of music, popular music, will change the world. And do you really believe that, or do you believe that music is a reflection of the world?
Yeah, well, it's always a reflection. But, like, if they... See, then, well, the reflection of the world is like blues. That's where the music... That's where that part of the music is at. But then you got this other kind of music that's trying to come around. It's not sunshine music necessarily, it's, you know, but it's like a more easier type of thing with less words, you know, and more meaning to it, you know. And you don't have to be singing about love all the time in order to give love to the people, you know. You don't have to keep flashing those words, love, all the time. But I don't know, maybe I was just feeling all nice and enthusiastic when I said that. But no, I can't take back on that because it's a nice thought. I think there's no reason why I couldn't. It was organized like a...
Do you want to do that personally, though? I mean, do you want to change the world?
Well, I like to take part in it. Changing reality, probably. Not what the way I know it, necessarily, but the way that it would get along a little better. As it were, old and young don't clash so much together.
What are the things that you would like to see change?
Oh, I don't know. More color in the streets, probably. I mean...
Again, that was Jimi Hendrix's final interview, given just about a week before he died. And that's where the book concludes. But let's talk about that for just a second there. Let me set the stage for you. Hendrix left New York City. His brand new recording studio, Electric Lady Studios, just opened up in New York, and he was having a blast with it. I mean, finally, he didn't have to worry about expensive studio time. He could spend that. But he was kind of drawn away from that by his manager, who's told him that he had to get back out on the road and pay for the studio, along with some other bills that were escalating there. So Hendrix left on a European tour. There was also pressure under him by the record company, who hadn't had a studio album out. Warner Brothers hadn't had a studio album out since 1968, and here it is, 1970. They got frustrated and put a Smash Hits album out in 1969. So Hendrix is under pressure from them to put something out by Christmas time. Also add to the chaos and confusion there, too. Hendrix's band just dissolved after a few shows on this European tour. September 6th, in the Alephaemar in Germany, Hendrix gave his final concert. Billy Cox had been given some punch that was laced with LSD. He had his first LSD experience, and it was just horrible. He needed to go back to the United States and recuperate. Mitch Mitchell's wife had just given birth to their daughter, and he needed to spend some time with them. So all of a sudden, Hendrix has no band. He has all these European dates lined up, and they're freaking out in America for another album there. So this interview was done under that stressful situation there. So if you listen to the entire interview, you can really get that sense from Hendrix that things were kind of very uncertain there, and it really comes through, and that's included in the book also. But I felt there should be something else besides these Hendrix interviews, and included an interview I did with Eric Burdon of the Animals in 1995 when I was doing Straight Ahead. Here he is holding a copy of the magazine up. I felt Eric Burdon was important because he knew Jimmy for a long period of time. He saw Hendrix play at the Paramount Theater in 1965 when Little Richard got fired from the bill there with Soupy Sales and a few other crazy teen acts, British invasion acts. And he subdued Little Richard in a freight elevator, and you can read about that in Becoming Jimi Hendrix. It was just a wild scene. So Eric Burdon and Chas Chandler was there too, witnessed that. So I felt that was good to have somebody there. But Burdon also knew him in 66 when Hendrix was putting together the Jimi Hendrix Experience in 67 in Monterey, the crisscrossed tours in 68, 69, 70. And Eric Burdon and War, his new group War, was the first. They were doing a live appearance at the Ronnie Scott's Club in England, and he invited Hendrix to come and jam with him. And it turned out to be Hendrix's final public appearance performance with Eric Burdon and War. So there's an interview with Eric Burdon. But if you go to my website, steveroby.com, you can read an interview with Monica Danman, the last lady he was with before he died. And this is an unpublished interview that was done with a screenplay writer who interviewed her in 1994. So he's asking here some very detailed questions, and we can give that a listen to now, a short listen to that.
Oh, man, Monica, you have pictures here that are just incredible.
I want to see
them. I don't care if it's a little out of focus. You know, it doesn't matter. It's beautiful.
I mean, I've got more than that, but they are the best ones, really.
This is a photo.
The same. This is the innocent Jimmy that could have been in Seattle as a youth with his broom, you know? I mean, this is the same one.
That is a real Jimmy. That is not. That was him, the person.
Because the real artist has an eternal child that never dies.
Yeah.
And this is, you photographed it. This is the proof. Oh, man. for me to envision him when I write, this is very important for me to have seen. That was his whole struggle, to keep that child alive. That was it.
Mm-hmm. And he kept it alive.
He kept it alive, you know. One and thing, it's the child here that's sad, because the child knows something that the man doesn't at this point. He, mm-hmm. The child knows he's going to die. There's like a sadness and a resignation to it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Like I said before, I mean, before the last few days before his death, there were certain things he said, you know, mm-hmm. which made me later... I mean, we talked so much the last few days, and so there were scattered these what he said to me, and it didn't trigger anything in me. So there was one time where he said to me, "I want you never to forget that if I'm not with you anymore, my spirit will be always with you." So I said to him, "I said, what do you mean?"
When was this, like 3 days?
That was about 3 days or 2 days before he died. And I said, what do you mean? I said, we will be together, so why do you say that? He said, oh, I just want you not to forget that my spirit will be always with you. So it didn't sound... So I said, what do you precisely mean? And I think he cottoned on that something disturbed me there. So he said to me, he said, well... If I'm on tour, for example...
He's putting you at ease.
And he was putting me at ease this way, and I sort of fell for it, because he went then quickly into another subject, and as usually something very, very interesting, mm-hmm. you know. So I forgot about that. Mm-hmm. Only after he died, I remembered this, for example, you know. But there were little... That was the strongest, where I thought something is not quite right the way he says it.
So again, that's an interview with Monica Dammann. That's bonus material on my website. If you go to my website and look under bonus material, you can read that interview and an interview done with Hendrix in 1967. Those two interviews are not in the book. So that's fun to read. It's on my website there too. So that kind of wraps up my discussion tonight there. And this is the fun part of the event for me, is when I can turn it over to you, and hopefully you've got some really good questions for me tonight. And thank you again for coming. Who's got the first question? Gentleman up front. Okay, let me repeat the question so everybody can hear. The question was about Michael Jeffrey, Jimmy's manager. He was his co-manager, then became his manager when Chaz Chandler pulled out. So the question is what actually happened to Michael Jeffrey? In 1973, there was an airplane strike, and he was traveling to Mallorca, Spain, if I believe, and there was a head-on collision, and they never recovered the bodies. There's kind of a conspiracy theory that goes around with that Michael didn't like to fly a lot, and since his body was recovered and he was kind of a shifty character moving around to avoid the taxes, sending Jimmy's money along with some other artists down to the Bahamas to get a bit of a tax shelter thing going on there. Is Michael Jeffrey still alive? I kind of doubt it. I know a lot of people think that, you know, he may have pulled something off like that. Wow, if he did, there's a story there. I don't think he did. I think he's dead.
It was something else. Somebody said that there was a mafia in England that ran clubs and kind of controlled the whole nightclub scene. I forgot their name. They were twin brothers. Hmm. And some people had thought that maybe they had murdered Jimmy in some sort of connection with Jeffrey. Jimmy wanted to leave his contract. He wanted a new manager.
There's quite a few conspiracy theories, and I talk about them briefly in the book there, but I don't go into it because this book is more of a celebration on Jimmy's words and what he actually said and his life story in his own words there. And I kind of mention that in the book, that I kind of leave it to people, if they want to explore those theories, that they go on the internet, and there's tons of forums and there's tons of theories out there. Briefly, I'll name a couple for you that I've heard, that the CIA and the FBI killed Jimmy because he was sided with the Black Panthers and he was starting to come out and be very vocal about kind of his anti-war movements against the Vietnam War. Tappy Wright, Jimmy's former road manager, came out and said that Michael Jeffrey conspired to kill Jimmy, hired some thugs to pour red wine down his throat and kill him. That theory has been disproved recently, and Tappy Wright has kind of gone into hiding about that. If you Google his name, you can find out, you know, that was exposed. That really didn't happen there. But, I mean, I have my opinion on what happened. I really think he was with the wrong lady at the wrong time, who was very naive of how to handle rock stars. I think she should have given him some more information about the painkillers that she had in her possession, that he took nine painkillers there that were practically triple strength of what you should take. Again, I think it was a naive situation there. The thing is, I don't think we'll really ever know why he died. We know how he died. He suffocated on his own vomit. But there's a good 3 to 5 hour gap there of how long it took for the paramedics to arrive, the condition he was in, and it's a debate that I think will never be settled there. So I hope that answers your question. Next question, please. A good question. The question was he driven perhaps to the point of suicide because he was under stress? I've recently read an article by a gentleman named Cesar Gleebeck, who's put out a 50-page pamphlet of his theory of how Jimmy died. And he kind of suggests that suicide should be considered. But, you know, I kind of have some troubles with that. I mean, Jimmy really wanted this new album to come out. Yeah, he was frustrated with the band falling apart, but he would have got something together eventually. I mean, Jimmy's whole life was music. And he wasn't, I don't think, depressed at that point that much to end it all right then there. So, again, an unanswered situation there. Gentleman behind you? I wish I had. I first heard his music in 67. I was 12 years old. I saw my first Hendrix concert at 13. I really had to convince my parents to let me go see him at the Oakland Coliseum. I saw his last American concert when I was 15 in Hawaii. Again, I had to get a $5 advance on my allowance to see him. But the closest I ever got was about as far as this person is right here in front of me. I rushed the stage in Honolulu, and he did the encore of All Along the Watchtower. So I made eye contact maybe for 5 seconds there, and I saw his amps. But that was the closest I ever got. But and working for his family for a brief period of time, that's the closest connection I ever had. The question is, do I think Jimmy was fading out, or he was? I think he was moving definitely in a different direction, and he talks about that in this last interview. There's definitely signs that he was getting into jazz rock fusion. There was a opportunity for him and Miles Davis and Tony Williams to record. He did some jams with John McLaughlin, the great jazz guitarist. He loved Ross on Roland Kirk's music. He did a early rap record. Well, it wasn't really called rap then. They were jail toast, prison rhymes, with The Last Poets, Doriella DuFontaine. Look that up on YouTube if you haven't heard that tonight. Go Google Doriella DuFontaine. Incredible stuff that Jimmy was just starting to get into. And he talks about starting something new. I mean, it was the 70s. God, I wish he'd survived the 70s. Maybe we wouldn't have had disco or something like that. But he was definitely going in a new direction, I think. Yeah. Let's see. Let's go with this lady. Yes, hi. The question is, if I heard you right, was do I play guitar? And did that help me? No, I only play air guitar, and I kind of faked it when I was on stage playing Purple Haze with 500 people there. I used to be a drummer, but yeah, I mean, I wish I could play guitar. I mean, I love it, yeah. Let's go over here, then I'll go to you, gentlemen. Yeah, so the question is, how did management feel about Hendrix kind of changing the game here? So, and what was the dynamic buildup between the three of those guys? Well, let's break down the Band of Gypsies real quick here. So it was formed in 1969. Jimmy brought in his old friend, good buddy from his Army days, back at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, Billy Cox. He really thought Billy linked in bass playing better than Noel Redding. Noel Redding wanted to be a rhythm guitar player and not a bass player. And so he and Jimmy worked out a lot of things there. So he brought Billy Cox in. And the drummer was Buddy Miles, who Jimmy had jammed with, and actually knew, when I was researching Becoming Jimi Hendrix, the two of them met up in Canada when Jimmy was with the Isley Brothers. So they go way back. So Jimmy wanted to change it up, get into some gut bucket funk and some R&B sounds that wasn't played before, and especially if you've ever heard his rendition of Machine Gun. It'll blow your mind away. So, yes, management didn't want the Band of Gypsies. There's an interview I got a hold of through EMP with Buddy Miles, and he says that Michael Jeffrey was definitely a racist, and he did everything he could to put an end to the Band of Gypsies, as far as, according to Buddy Miles, was giving Jimmy some bad acid. And the last appearance they did was in early, I'm going to say January 28th, 1970, at a Vietnam Memorial concert. And Hendrix just played two songs, couldn't play anymore, sat on stage for a while, and they had to take him off stage. And that was the end of the Band of Gypsies, yeah. Okay, the question was, what are the origins of the song Purple Haze? Okay, so Jimmy was a huge science fiction fan. He could just gobble that stuff up. I interviewed Kim Fowley, the record producer and singer in Becoming Jimi Hendrix, and he told me an incredible story that when Jimmy arrived in England, he had a chest full of science fiction books that he would just devour every night and just read. And so one of his favorite authors was Philip Farmer, who wrote a book called Night of Light, which is about this planet called Dante's Joy, and there was this purple haze that would have an effect on the inhabitants of Dante's Joy that Jimmy wrote about. And Jimmy also talks about in several other interviews about this dream he had about walking underwater. So that's it has more science fiction origins, like a lot of Hendrix's songs do. The question is, how did I arrive on some of the selections of the interviews in the book? And there are a lot of interviews to choose from. In fact, when I was doing this book tour, I came across a gentleman down in Southern California who has the most incredible collection of Hendrix magazines, newspapers, everything like that. But, you know, there's some repetition that I found in a lot of the Hendrix interviews where Hendrix is asked the same type of question. And I excluded those, and just so that they go in chronological order, and they have Jimmy telling his own life story. So, yeah, there was a few I skipped over. The book that influenced me to write this book was a book on John Coltrane called Coltrane on Coltrane. And I thought to myself, I said, why isn't there a book on Jimmy of just his interviews? Now, I got to give a lot of credit to the author of that book, Chris DeVito. He got, I would say, 98% of all the interviews that John Coltrane did and put them in that book. Incredible goal, but I just couldn't do it with this book here. I thought, you know, for the reader, you know, I just put some of the best interviews there. Sir? Okay, so the question is, yes, was there a Jimi Hendrix pornography tape of Jimmy with a couple ladies that was released on DVD? Yes, there was. About 3 or 4 years ago, a company... They actually approached me to authorize this, to say if this was Jimmy performing, having sex with a couple of ladies there. I looked at that, and the first thing is, it's definitely not Jimmy. It's definitely not. Yeah, it was put out there. They've got Cynthia Pat Plastercaster, who immortalized Jimmy's genitalia. I can say that here, I think, right? In form there. But she said it's Jimmy, but everybody that I've talked to says it's not Jimmy. I've got somebody waving their hands way up on the top there with a question. The question is, we're talking about some of Jimmy's old Seattle friends that he played with when he was growing up here in Seattle. I've met Sammy Drain. Yes, Sammy played with. I'm not sure of the other gentleman that you mentioned. Okay. Way over in the corner there. Okay, let's take them in steps here. So the first question is, who owns the rights to Jimi Hendrix's music? Right?
Yes.
Okay, so up until 1995, it was controlled by Alan Douglas, a New York producer who Jimmy knew, Leo Brandt and his attorneys, and some of the record companies had control of it. The real brief explanation of that is that Al Hendrix won a lawsuit, regained the rights back to Jimmy's music and so forth, and formed a company called Experience Hendrix, and they essentially own the rights to all Jimmy's music and videos and such. The question is, how many Jimi Hendrix followers are... millions? millions all around the world. One of the great parts of being a Hendrix author is getting out and meeting folks like you that come to these things out there. You know, it's a good question. It's like people from my generation are getting older, dying off, and everything like that. But there is a new generation coming along that really appreciates his music. And I love talking to them about what they hear in Jimmy's music, and if it's the same thing I heard as a teenager, and why it stands the test of time, as opposed to, say, Taylor Swift's music or Justin Bieber's music, which I don't think in 40 years from now we will be in this room talking about. Go with this gentleman, then I'll go with you. The question is, how far did Jimmy and Miles Davis explore putting out an album together, recording together? Very good question. And in my first book, which is out of print now, called Black Gold, The Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix, I go into a whole section of that. And I used as a reference point, and I'm sure they have it at the library here, is Miles Davis's autobiography with the author Quincy Trope, if I'm correct. And Miles talks about he and Jimmy getting together in 1969. They had a mutual friend. They met at a boutique in New York called the Nudist Colony. And they got together, and Alan Douglas, who was the producer at that time, said, let's get you guys in the studio. So before that, they had a rough rehearsal at Miles Davis's apartment, I believe it was. And Miles gave Jimmy some sheet music to read and said, okay, I'll play this, you play that on guitar. And I can't say exactly what Miles said, but he says Jimmy looked at it and just had a blank stare, but he caught on really quick after, you know, I showed him what to play and everything like that. So there was a session set up by Alan Douglas for Miles Davis and Tony Williams to play together in 1969. However, at the last minute, Miles Davis called to the studio and said, I want $50,000 up front for me tonight to do this session. Otherwise, I'm not going to play it. Alan Douglas said, no, the money's not there. Tony Williams, unbeknownst to what the telephone call Miles Davis gave, also said the same thing. I want 50 grand tonight. Otherwise, I'm not showing up to the studio. No money there, no session. But there was an opportunity in 1970 for them to get together. So I think they were heading in that direction. Well, the question is there still some unreleased material that's floating out there? There's tons of people that still have music that is unreleased. And it's amazing that Jimmy crammed at least 40 or plus years of music into that four-year time period that he was making music and recording it. So yeah, it's still out there. People keep coming up to me and saying, hey, look, I've got this tape. Okay, last question. Who hasn't asked a question before? You've asked one. Let me go with somebody else that hasn't. You've already asked a question. You get to ask the last question. What's the story behind the song Manic Depression? Jimmy had fits of depression a lot. He admits in that Dick Cavett interview that he had three nervous breakdowns. And Dick Cavett says, you mean physical breakdowns, don't? Nobody really has nervous breakdowns. Jimmy said, yes, while I've been in this band, while I've been in this music. So and a lot of the girlfriends that I interviewed too said that he would have fits of rage, he was supposedly a really nice, mellow guy off stage, very humble, very quiet. But there were times when he would just go off. They would tell me there. Yeah, it's kind of. Well, I think we've come to the conclusion here. Thank you all for coming. I'd be happy to sign some books for you. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.